21341 CB, City of Cedar Park, which is funded by Peña, individually on behalf of CBLP, a minor. Corina de la Peña, individually on behalf of the estate of CBLP.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, Justice Benavides, and Justice Tiarina. The City of Cedar Park is immune from all of Appellee De La Peña's claims. And to arrive at this conclusion, really we have to do a close analysis of the statute first and foremost, but we have to analyze that statute through the prism that the Texas Supreme Court has given us in the cases of Miranda and later Sampson in 2016. And so it's undisputed the City of Cedar Park is a governmental entity under Section 101.021 of the Texas Tort Claims Act. And so what that does is it allows us governmental immunity in certain circumstances. And this is one of those circumstances, potentially, because this incident took place during a recreational activity at a municipal pool. Here, the municipal pool was called the Buttercup Pool. Now, the Texas Supreme Court has analyzed this statute, and it really allows for just three claims to be waived. The first one is if a public automobile is involved in injuring a claimant. We don't have that here. There's no automobile. And the second one is under the second section of the statute, and it allows for claims that arise under a injury to a claimant that is brought about by the government's employee's use through a respondent superior theory of personal property. So, for example, if I pick something up and my employee negligently strikes someone with it or something like that, that would be a waived claim within the meaning of the statute. Conversely, the only other claim that is available under this statute is a premises defect claim, and specifically a premises defect claim that is specifically cabined by the Texas Tort Claims Act to a condition of tangible real property. It does not allow for a claim arising generally from a use of real property. The Texas Supreme Court was very clear about that in a case called Sampson versus the City University of Texas. And that case is quite clear on that. And it shows that this claim was foreclosed in a previous case called Miranda, which occurred in 2004. And essentially what it is the Tort Act scheme of limited waiver of immunity from suit does not allow plaintiffs to circumvent the heightened standards of a premises defect claim contained in Section 101.022, the next statute over, by recasting the same claims as relating to the negligent condition or use of tangible real property. And that's from Miranda, the case from 2004. Now that language was crystallized by Sampson when the Texas Supreme Court in 2016 really took a deep dive onto this issue and really tried to separate out, all right, what is a contemporaneously negligent activity brought about by a governmental unit's use of personal property? Again, the thing that I've picked up and my employee negligently struck someone with, that would be a waived claim. Or the premises defect claim, again, cabined, and I'll get into this a little bit later, by Sampson, to a tangible condition of property. It has to be a tangible condition, which means that claims like that that might arise under something like Timberwalk for a failure to provide security, that would not be waived under 101.021 of the Texas Tort Claims Act.
Here, as you know, the principal argument seems to be in the implementation of the policies that allowed allegedly not enough people there to supervise the children that were in the pool. Negligent implementation of the policies. Clearly, the city has these policies in place for a reason, to maintain safe conditions there. How does that factor in here?
I was about to say, Chief Justice, you helped me out on that one quite a lot. Appellee's principal case in chief in their response brief is the case of Hester. And this court is well familiar with Hester from the 2019 opinion that you yourself wrote, Chief Justice, in Kirstein. And essentially what it is that if your complaint about a negligent implementation of policy still does not involve a use of personal property or a conditional defect of a premises, it still breaks the causal chain to sufficiently waive the city's liability. For example, in the
Kirstein case, it was far removed, it seems like. There was a TV set, I think that they were using as a tangible property because the guards were watching that instead of paying attention to the people that were being detained. Here, it's clear, I mean, it's the pool we're talking about, obviously, and it's the negligent implementation of these policies which resulted in this now being a very dangerous situation.
No, Chief Justice, I don't think so, because I think we're still very attenuated here. And keep in mind that appellees, in pleading that claim of a negligent implementation, the use that they're alleging is the use of real property, which is a claim that is completely foreclosed in Sampson and Miranda. So that use is
I mean, you make a big point of it in your brief to talk about this policy that the city has and everything that the city took as to how many people, how many was going to be there in order to ensure the safety of those who attended the poll. And there was definitely a failure to follow that policy. So that's not the use of the pool, it is the use of the property, but it's that policy. That are we going to allow policies to exist and then not use them when they're not? Well, it doesn't matter whether we have a policy. Then why the policy, right? So let's take a big step back today. So if we don't have policies and we don't take them back, and we're going to give you sovereign immunity. Then what is going to do any government agency never have safety policies to continue?
Well, the key distinguishment I'd say, Justice Benavides, is when you have. A waiver in the statute for, in this case, the Texas Tort Claims Act, that is undisputedly the only waiver that we have here. And so negligence can arise and sound in policy if, through that policy, we can find our way to a use of personal property, again, that thing that I can pick up and negligently strike someone with, or a condition of real property. And so the problem that we keep running into here is, for example, if the pool had a lot of broken glass in it, and the recreational use statute applies in this case, 75.002, my only duty to them is to a trespasser, so it's a gross negligence standard as well. But say, for example, I have a policy at my pool that no broken glass, no cloudy water, nothing like that. But I know that the water's cloudy, or I know that there's glass in the water. Then, if my policies were violated and those defects were still there, those are defects in the condition of the real property, which then, through the statute of 101.021, would allow for a waiver of sovereign immunity in this case. And their policies, you know, would absolutely serve a purpose. However, correct, Your Honor, because for a premises defect case, again, cabined by Sampson, which requires that it be a condition of the property.
Well, is the condition of the property not that there wasn't sufficient lifeguards in order to supervise the children?
Well, again, your court helps me out again with that issue in the case of Petoniak, which approved the case of Vela. So I believe the case was Guadalupe Blanco River versus Petoniak. And in that case, this court took a very strong stance that a premises defect cannot be the presence or the lack of a person, because people are not, you know, part of the property. You know, I can't say, you know, Justice Tiarina is a fixture of this courtroom, and therefore, you know, the lack of Justice Tiarina is possibly a premises defect. You know, people simply cannot be fixtures of the property sufficient to become premises defects.
What about the bin which contained the life jackets? I realize this is a disputed issue, but again, if we find fact issues here, then it's something appropriate for the trial court.
Oh, well, Your Honor,
the bin itself could be tangible property. If it's true that the life jackets are not really readily available or visible to the participants, could that be a violation of the policy as well as
So I think it's important for the So I think it's important for the court to keep in mind that in the two kinds of cases, there's a contemporaneously negligent activity, and those can only be under a use of personal property. Again, that thing that I can pick up and accidentally be negligent with. And then there's fixtures to the premises. Here, I would argue that there really isn't a fact question about these life jackets, Your Honor. You know, I think I cited to the Texas, I mean, to, excuse me, to the United States Supreme Court, and a lot of my practice is federal, so I apologize that I couldn't lay hands on a Texas case immediately, but the United States Supreme Court says that, you know, when you have video evidence of something that, you know, completely removes all doubt to a fact question, you know, this court need not, concern itself with, you know, what's in the opposing counsel's pleadings. If the video in the record is sufficient to remove all doubt, there is no fact question for all intents and purposes. And so, Your Honor, I'd say that the City of Cedar Park's officer, Michael Ott, clearly walks by that basket during rescue operations, so it is absolutely contemporaneous in time, walks by that basket, and there are several life jackets in that basket. So I'd say, you know, what we're hitting on now is the integral safety doctrine. And in that situation, the integral safety doctrine is an exception to the general theory under Cowan, the Texas Supreme Court, that says a mere non-use of property is not sufficient to waive my city's liability under 101.021 of the Texas Tort Claims Act. And so to get around that non-use exception, you have to plead the integral safety doctrine. But that exception only applies if the city or whatever governmental unit you're talking about has provided the property to them, yet it's missing something. So for example, if I provided someone with water wings, but the water wings didn't have any air in it, and I knew that the water wings didn't have any air in it, yet I, you know, sent them out into the water anyway, potentially now we have a case where the integral safety doctrine has been violated because I gave them property, it was missing this integral safety component, the air in the water wings, and I proceeded with conscious indifference. That could potentially be sufficient to waive my liability under the integral safety exception doctrine. However, the Texas Supreme Court in North Richland Hills versus Friend has made it very clear to all courts in Texas that this is the outer bounds of the limit, and unless you have that exact factual scenario, this cannot apply. And it doesn't apply here because the record is completely clear, both from the video evidence and from the written police statements, that my city didn't give CD, the decedent in this case, any property. She showed up in a camp t-shirt that was, you know, bright lime green, and she showed up in her own swimming suit. I never gave her anything. I merely made available life jackets in a bin nearby. And simply making something available is a non-use, and it is in no way sufficient to trigger the integral safety exception doctrine.
Did the city have a policy of making sure that children of a certain age or of certain needs be provided a life jacket before entering the water?
I don't believe that was specifically articulated in the policy, and it's because the city would rely on entities like, you know, the camp here in this case, the High Hope Summer Camp, to understand what children that they are bringing themselves have special needs and potentially need extra safety precautions in order to be safe around the pool. Here, there is no evidence in the record that my city was ever made aware that a child with CD's particular special needs was coming to the pool. I don't believe that's anywhere in the record. The only policy that the city had with regard to supervision, with the exception of the aquatic safety plan that my city commissioned to establish that we needed two lifeguards, you know, in order to have everyone properly supervised, is that we generally adopted the Texas Child Protective Services little graph that says, you know, how many supervisors you would need for the private entity to come in to monitor children of a certain age. And if my math worked out correctly, I didn't do the math personally, so hopefully it's a little bit more valuable. By my calculations, you would need 12 staff members from the city, from the camp High Hopes, to properly have them supervised under the policy. And they had 12 camp members. And again, this comes back to...
I thought they had 10.
Your Honor, there were 10. In Chicken Scratch, handwritten on the admission ticket, there was a 10 written. However, again, this is one of those issues where the body camera and the signed written police statements remove all doubt of a fact question in this. There's a footnote in my... in my brief in chief, where I meticulously lay out the timestamp where every single one of these camp staff members identify themselves to the police, and if you count them all up, there were 13 people there, including the bus driver, and 12 camp staff members there who were not the bus driver and therefore responsible for supervising. So there is no fact question about how many camp staff members were there due to the video evidence removing all doubt about this fact question. And I will reserve my 20 seconds for rebuttal.
May it please the court. As stated in our brief, the De La Pena family properly invoked the trial court's jurisdiction by pleading and demonstrating gross negligence by the city of Cedar Park for its use and operation of Buttercup Pool. The city's use and operation was grossly negligent because it violated its own safety policies, as we were just discussing, and procedures, which required that the city employees, the lifeguards, should have denied the High Hopes camp access to the pool in the first place. Sure, the trial court found that there was a disputed fact issue with that. They saw evidence in the form of testimony, live testimony presented at the hearing from a bystander. They heard evidence about the chicken scratched receipt, which came from the actual pool themselves, indicating that there were 10 lifeguards. And there was a question of a lifeguard that was not present that day that was on the schedule. So there were disputed fact issues, and the trial court heard all of these when determining that there was a fact issue that would get us past the pleaded jurisdiction. So that is how I would respond to that. I would also like to briefly respond, while it's on my mind, to the, I guess, the indication that there was no policy regarding life jackets. The evidence in the record shows that the city followed the Ellis & Associates lifeguard manual, and that manual says that factors that contribute to these risks, risk of drowning and death, include a lack of supervision, not wearing life jackets, and attendance with a camp daycare group. And that's in the record at SCR 170. And also in that same manual, children and non-swimmers or weak swimmers wearing no life jacket are more subject to being rescued by lifeguards. I think there's a fact question to that as well, but I think that the lifeguards, when the city adopts a policy that they're going to have a certain amount of lifeguards and they're going to undertake these protocols for which someone shall be denied access if they don't abide by them, I think they kind of adopt the taking care of the kids by the lifeguards at that point. And they do it.
I'm going to step backwards and take a step, because the appellant seems to argue that it doesn't matter. And that the city could have literally a violation of it, but it still doesn't waive the immunity that this city is still protected. That there could have been, no matter whether there was 5 or 10 or 12 camp counselors, and it didn't mean whether they provided a vest, because that's a non-use of a personal arm. So it doesn't seem to matter whether there's a fact issue. They're just saying they're immune.
Sure. I think that governments and municipalities make these arguments all the time because they rely so heavily on sovereign immunity. But what we've seen in the cases
because
that are
protected by government, the legislature constitutes does some statutes that really protect them.
Absolutely. Understandable.
And for reasons that we understand, it's taxpayer money and so forth and so on. So how do we overcome that?
Sure. I think the waiver applies for it, and the cases that are briefed in our brief also give us a clear line to get there. I think that this is a proper waiver under Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code 101021B. I think that the reliance on Sampson, which is dicta, to overcome the contemporaneous use of this for the real property argument as well helps get us there. And I don't think this is out of line or broadening the waiver at all. I think these cases are so fact intensive that when you look at the facts of this particular case, with the contemporaneous nature of the policies not being followed while the kids were at the camp or at the pool, coupled with the fact that there's a nexus between what happens when you don't abide by the policy and then let the kids in the pool at that point as well, I think that it gets us there.
So you think that this is different from the Hester case and from the case out of our court?
Yes.
Factuals to give rise to sovereign immunity?
Correct. With the Kirstein case, again, y'all, this court, did reverse the, or I guess y'all affirmed the denial of the granting of the plea to the jurisdiction in that case. And while doing that, y'all did again, get us to the point where you explained that for immunity to be waived under the TTCA, the property must be more than a condition that makes the injury possible. And so you gave us still the ability to seek these types of claims in your holding while applying the facts to that case to allow for y'all to properly deny or grant the plea to the jurisdiction. And I think what's important there is that the nexus here is that we have to separate the lifeguards from the policy, right? We're talking about this non-use or that people can't be, they can't be considered the thing that it causes the nexus between the use of the property and our claim for waiver. But at the same time, it's the policy that we're talking about. And the policy happens to be the thing that they adopted. And so that, when abandoning enforcement of that policy contemporaneous with the action, I think that gets us there and holds us in line with y'all's holding in Kirstein as well.
So assume that we do find, as you've argued, a waiver in this case, and that takes us to the recreational use statute, for which you have to show gross negligence.
Correct.
Are you arguing that your violation of these policies rises to the level that's required under the recreational use statute?
Yes, we are. We are arguing that even if we don't have to replead and call it a premises defect case, that based on the holdings, that gross negligence would be the standard either way. And we do think that the judge at the trial court level at least found enough facts to say that there is likely to be, or there's at least a fact issue of gross negligence, which allows us to defeat the plea of the jurisdiction.
Oh, are you abandoning your negligence supervision in essence, your premise is defect, because you're going to the interpretation of the policy, which is a little different.
Correct. If the court finds that we need to replead, then we would, of course, like the ability to do that and make that alternative argument. So while I would say that the negligent supervision claim, we didn't amend it in the fact pattern of it, but we did in the actual argument and discussion part of our amended petition. So the supervision part, yes. However, should the court find that we need to replead this as a premises defects case, then we certainly will. I'd also briefly like to state that affirming the trial court would, I think, as I mentioned earlier, preserve the status quo of the law here. It would keep the cases to be analyzed based on very specific fact circumstances that give rise to a waiver. And so we think the simplest way for the court to maintain the status quo, not only in their courts, but from what we've heard in from the Supreme Court as well, would be to keep 101.021 analysis under the waiver very factual in nature. And so we think that the trial court level found the facts that they needed to get us there, and that to affirm their ruling denying the city's plea to the jurisdiction would absolutely be in line with that. With regard to Sampson, as briefed in our SIR reply, it is dicta. And there's another case called Del Lago's Partners, in which Justice Wainwright, in the dissent, said that that allowing everything to be the premises defects case, such as counsel suggests in Sampson, would be not in line with all of the holdings after Keach that kind of bifurcate these into the premises defect cases and the the use of real or tangible property. So I thought I would bring that to the court's attention as well. There are also facts that abound throughout this case that I think give us rise that we discuss in our brief as well, which allowed Judge Meacham at the trial court level to sufficiently find that there were enough fact issues to deny the plea to the jurisdiction. It's the number of the children at the pool. It was the bill for entry corresponded with the number of children at the pool. It was the policies about what will happen if you don't apply the correct application to come to the pool and don't list the proper number of children.
How How do you respond, though, to arguments made that there still needed to be something wrong with the pool that resulted in this unfortunate death?
Sure, we've never argued that. The pool was, as he said, crystal clear, and again, we think that not having the life jackets and not obeying the policies that you've adopted, which are policies that were Health and Human Services policies that you've then adopted and codified within your municipality, that isn't an extension of the pool's use, basically. So we've never argued, I think we did mention alternatively, that there was a witness who did say that there was a situation with the chairs. However, we know that there are cases out there that say use of the lifeguard chairs doesn't really get you there either. But we thought we would bring it to the court's attention regardless. I think when you take all these things together too, that's the use of the pool. I mean, that's what we're all there for. And people pay money to get into the pool. You pay for your entrance fee, and so to say that we get our immunity even if we don't provide lifeguards, even though we've adopted all of these rules, I think would lead to a result that is not what the legislature intended. And I think that's all that I've got for you guys right now. Do y'all have any more questions for me?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Justices. I've chicken scratched a few things in reply to counsel's arguments. First of all, there's this issue with Sampson being dicta and non-binding on this court or any other court on the issue of, you know, what's the difference between a premises defect case and a contemporaneous personal use of a personal property that affects an injury, and it is simply not dicta. You know, counsel filed a surreply and had the last word in this case, and they argue that Schumach, the case of State versus Schumach, was somehow, you know, an intervener between Miranda and Sampson, and that Sampson could not possibly have been anything other than dicta because Schumach would have then had to have been overruled, and counsel argues that Sampson would never have overruled Schumach sub silentio like that. But the issue is that Schumach didn't really discuss anything that we're talking about. It discussed the state of Texas's attempt to argue to the Supreme Court that the recreational use statute foreclosed premises liability cases in its entirety, rather than, as the Supreme Court eventually held, that the recreational use standard merely elevates the duty that a plaintiff is required to overcome, that being the duty that the city owes nothing more than a trespasser. And so the case simply doesn't stand for the proposition that Sampson is dicta in any way. Sampson really just crystallizes what Miranda in 2014 held, which I hate to read case law to the court, but Miranda again. I know, and I get cross-eyed. My vision's going to go at this rate. The Tort Claims Act, and this is Miranda again in 2004, the Tort Claims Act scheme of a limited waiver of immunity from suit does not allow plaintiffs to circumvent the heightened standards of a premises defect claim contained in Section 101.022 by recasting those same claims relating to the negligent condition or use of tangible, real property. And they cite that case that is even older than Miranda, which goes back to 74, which is the case of State versus Tennyson. And Sampson immediately continues that train of thought merely a few years ago in 2016, where it held, and this is again reading directly to you, in Texas Department of Parks and Wildlife versus Miranda, this court considered whether a claim can be both a premises defect claim and a claim relating to a condition or use of tangible real property and held that it cannot. So Sampson is in no way dicta that prevents this reading of 101.021 from a binding this court to the idea that you really only have three claims under Texas Civil Practice and Remedy Code 101.0212, and that is if you have a contemporaneously negligent use of personal property, you know, sort of a respondat superior, my employee picks something up and accidentally negligently hits someone with it, or a condition of the real property being defective. And again, I think I need to go into more detail about what Sampson held in my remaining 2 minutes, simply because it's very clear that these claims are different from the kinds of claims that I believe counsel referenced the De La Vista versus Smith case, which is that case about a hotel bar overserved some patrons of a fraternity party and a wedding party, and then they sort of came to blows because there was about 90 minutes of some drinking, and all the wait staff knew what was about to happen. They saw it boiling over, and they didn't do anything to stop it. That's a sort of a premises case that's almost like a pseudo-Timberwalk case, a failure to keep safe from a third-party criminal act. Regardless, Texas Tort Claims Acts do not follow that line of theory. And if I can find my case law for you guys very quickly. So here it is.
It sounds like it was a condition that created a defect.
Correct. And so, again, reading directly to you, this is from Sampson. When distinguishing between a negligent activity and a premises defect, this court has focused on whether the injury occurred by or as a contemporaneous result of the activity itself, a negligent activity, or rather by a condition created by the activity, a premises defect.
Why is it our case the first one?
Because there's no contemporaneous use of personal property. No one has picked something up and accidentally struck someone with it. All we're talking...
Cool doesn't call it.
No. So I don't believe there's any question that, you know, I didn't use life vest. I claim that I had life vest in this basket. I think the video clearly shows it. But I'd say even if I didn't have a basket, that's a non-use of property. So if I didn't have a basket at all, my immunity is still intact. And really quickly, just continuing on my train of thought, because my time is short, this is again from Sampson. Within the Tort Claims Act context, Sampson was very careful to distinguish that they're different. We have defined condition as either an intentional or inadvertent state of being. To state a condition claim under the Texas Tort Claims Act, there must be an allegation of defective or inadequate real property. That's this entire case, Your Honors. For a defective condition to be the basis for the complaint, the defect must pose a hazard in the intended and ordinary use of the property. As counsel admits, it was clear blue all the way to the bottom, and there was nothing wrong with the pool. Thank you.
Thank you.